This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The water crisis in Flint has thrust the struggling city into the glare of an international spotlight. Common questions are flying in. How did this happen? And would this crisis have happened in a city that was not largely poor or largely black? Andrew Highsmith is a professor of history at the University of California, Irvine. He lived in Flint from 2003 till 2006 while his wife did her medical residency there, and he was working on his PhD at the University of Michigan. That helped him understand that Flint's story reflects the transformation of modern American cities and why that has led to such deep racial and economic inequalities. His book is Demolition Means Progress, Flint, Michigan, and the Fate of the American Metropolis. Andrew Highsmith, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
I want to start right out with you with that incredibly Orwellian title, Demolition Means Progress. And this was actually a sign that you saw in Flint, right?
Indeed, I did. As you said, I was living in Flint from 2003 to 2006 and didn't know right away that I was going to write a book about Flint, but started exploring around the city and learning a bit more about its history. And during one of those explorations, I traveled to the north end of the city where General Motors used to operate a massive complex of Buick plants. And those plants had closed down just years prior. And after the plants closed, workers placed signs around the facility that said, "Demolition means progress," suggesting that the city couldn't really move forward to greatness until those old plants had met the wrecking ball. That got me really thinking about Flint's history and its long history of urban revitalization. And that's what ultimately led me toward writing this book. In the course of doing the research for that book, I realized that the Demolition Means Progress wasn't just a trite corporate slogan, although in many ways it was. I came to know that that also represented the operating ethos of the city's economic and political leadership throughout the bulk of the 20th century. And so I trace a series of revitalization campaigns in the book, and each of those ultimately led to the hardening of social inequalities in the Flint region. For me, Demolition Means Progress was a perfect title because it really helps to explain a lot about the dynamics of the city.
As we in Michigan have been watching reporters and bloggers and media from all over the world kind of come in and try to explain why Flint is in the desperate state it's in, the narratives kind of tend to land on, well, GM closed Buick City and then decay set in. But in your book, Demolition Means Progress, you take us back decades back before GM left town. How far back? And give us a sense of what was happening. Because as you say, there were waves of these.
Sure. I'm glad you asked that because I think in the reporting that we've seen so far on Flint's water crisis, a lot of it has focused on the issue of government mismanagement, or material that's historical tends to focus on, you know, a few recent plant closures, like you mentioned, the Buick closure in the late 1990s. But as I trace in the book, Flint's deindustrialization crisis, its depopulation and disinvestment crisis stretch back deep into the 20th century. One thing I discovered in writing the book is that really the origins of this crisis can be traced back to the post-World War II period. Prior to that, as Flint emerged as a manufacturing headquarters for General Motors, all of the city's industrial infrastructure was located inside of the city. But following World War II, actually beginning in 1940, during the war, GM worked through a new investment strategy that eyed the suburbs and rural areas for investment. And as evidence of that, between 1940 and 1960, GM built 8 new industrial complexes in the Flint metropolitan area, but all of those were located in the suburbs. And so because the city was unable to annex those new plants, it proved to be a blow to the city's tax base. At the same time, there were other out-migrations happening in Flint that would prove to be equally important, but certainly the shifting of GM's industrial plants from the city to the suburbs had tremendous ramifications for residents of Flint, but also for city government.
Particularly, take us into city government, because they're certainly getting put on the hot seat now.
I mean, through the course of these migrations, Flint lost a substantial portion of its tax base. And as I said, because they were unable to annex those plants, it represented a huge blow to the local economy, to the local tax base. Moving on in the 20th century, as GM began shifting its plants outside of the region altogether, that presented even greater obstacles to city officials and local residents. And so as a result of the loss of these plants, and to give you a sense of this, consider the fact that in the 1950s, at GM's peak employment in the city, there were over 80,000 high-paid auto workers in the Flint metropolitan area. By the dawn of the new millennium, that number was under 10,000. And so that meant smaller tax revenues. It translated into multi-million dollar budget deficits in the city. And all of that really laid the groundwork for the declaration of financial emergency in 2011.
And this is certainly a very familiar tune for anyone who followed the Detroit bankruptcy.
Absolutely.
And when I think of that process, as you say, depopulation, disinvestment, and deindustrialization, those are all three defining features of how Flint became what it is today in your work. Can you give us a sense of what you learned that these factors looked like on the ground, what it was like in the city of Flint as these factors came into play?
If you want to move back to the post-World War II period.
Mm-hmm. Was that the New Flint? Is that what was called New Flint?
That happened during the end of that post-war period in the late 1950s. As GM was building these new plants in the suburbs, it wasn't immediately apparent that they were going to cause or they were going to be the first signs of deindustrialization, because when GM moved those plants, they actually wanted the city to annex them. They wanted them to become a part of Flint. So they weren't in that particular period of time seeking to escape the city. GM supported the annexation of those plants. GM also supported a regional government plan called New Flint. And that plan, which was proposed in 1957 and 1958, was to consolidate Flint and all of its urbanized suburbs into one regional government. And that plan met enormous resistance from suburbanites who had also relocated from the city to the suburbs following World War II. They didn't want to share those resources with the city, and so they organized in opposition to the New Flint plan, and ultimately they were able to get their way. The Supreme Court invalidated an election that was to be held in 1958 on this proposal. And so in the wake of the failure of New Flint and the inability of the city to annex these plants, governments in the region became highly fragmented. And that also had tremendous repercussions for the people of Flint.
I'm speaking with Andrew Highsmith, who's a professor of history at the University of California, Irvine. He lived in Flint from 2003 to 2006. His book, Demolition Means Progress, explores how the push for urban renewal in Flint led to so many ills: suburbanization, racial and economic division, political fragmentation, deindustrialization. And Andrew sees Flint as a vivid example of what's happened in America's big industrial city. So, Andrew, you see this as not just a Flint story, but something that really has been played out in other big American cities?
Absolutely. Every city is unique in its own way, and Flint, of course, is as well. But the sorts of outward migrations that I trace in Demolition Means Progress were also occurring in cities across the United States during these same years. While there are differences, to be sure, between Flint and other places, these are largely differences of degree and not of kind. As we talked about before, there were waves of deindustrialization, disinvestment, and depopulation that dramatically affected the city of Flint during the second half of the 20th century. I spoke already about the outmigration of industrial facilities from cities to suburbs. That was occurring not only in Flint, but all across the country, in particular in places like Detroit, which also suffered greatly due to the decline of manufacturing in the central city. But at the same time, there was a mass migration of white taxpayers occurring from cities to suburbs as well. And this migration, like the outmigration of industry, was government-sponsored, government-endorsed. And so following World War II, millions of Americans, including tens of thousands of Flint residents, almost all of them white, relocated from central cities to more racially homogeneous suburbs. And because the federal housing policies that enabled these sorts of migrations were generally made available only to whites, that meant increasing levels of racial segregation between cities and suburbs. It contributed to greater wealth gaps between black urban residents and white suburbanites. And it contributed to greater chasms, economic chasms, between cities and suburbs. These were also extremely important in driving Flint's transformation.
Do you think segregation in Flint was worse than in other northern industrial cities?
I think so. I think that, I mean, Flint has been historically, for most of the last 75 years, one of the most racially segregated cities and metropolitan areas in the country, and it continues to hold that designation today. The scope of it and the extent of it and the severity of it in Flint seem to be greater than in many other places. But Flint, again, these differences are differences of degree and not of kind. Entrenched racial segregation is a problem all throughout the United States, not just in so-called rust-belt cities like Flint.
It's interesting to watch comments and sparring, if you will, on social media over all the stories about the Flint water crisis. And you see think pieces about racism and pushing the idea that a white Republican state leadership just didn't get too worried about a city that has a lot of poor black Democratic voters. The other day I saw a comment about stop saying it's racial, noting there are a lot of white people, white families who are caught in this water crisis. And I'm wondering if you look at this and as you follow the stories that are coming out, do you see this as racism or classism or both?
I see them as deeply interconnected. You're right to point out that Flint still has a sizable white population. Although it's a majority African-American city, there are tens of thousands of whites who remain in the city, many of them poor and working class, and they too have been affected by this crisis. So I see race and class operating in tandem here. It's not a question of one or the other, it's both.
The last chapter of your book, great title, America is a Thousand Flints. What do you think are the most important lessons that we, not only as a state, but as a country, can learn from what's playing out right now in Flint?
Well, I think the title of that epilogue, I think, is especially relevant to what we're seeing happening today in Flint and other cities with the crisis in infrastructure that has proceeded from decades of deindustrialization, disinvestment, depopulation, and of course, austerity as well. What we've seen happen in the city of Flint is that we can't cut our way out of these infrastructure problems. Flint, by no means, is unique in this regard. Austerity has come to be the MO of government officials in fiscally obsessed cities across the country. And these sorts of cuts have proven to be devastating for the quality of life in our urban centers, but also for the quality of infrastructure. While our attention right now is on Flint, and it rightfully should be, we could very well be back in Detroit in a few years from now talking about a bridge collapse or some other preventable calamity that has its roots in these larger structural inequities that I try to trace in the book. America really is a thousand Flints, and the Flint water crisis, I think, underscores that.
Andrew Highsmith's book is titled Demolition Means Progress, Flint, Michigan, and the Fate of the American Metropolis. Andrew, it was great talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.